Welcome back to another episode of Pursuit of Evolution. Today's guest is Kristen Carbone of Brilliantly. Kristen's mom died of metastatic breast cancer at the age of 49, and after Kristen herself went through years of expensive and emotionally taxing screenings, finding a lump and learning more about her own hereditary risks, made the decision to have a preventative mastectomy and reconstruction in 2013. Since 2017, she has started a portrait project, a corrective exercise program, and hosted numerous events about quality of life issues facing this community. She wants to broaden the scope of what's out there for navigating life after an experience with breast cancer. And after almost 4 years of R&D, Brilliantly Warm, her app-controlled wearable warming device that fits in any bra, launched last year. So let's get to it.
All right, to kick things off really quick, will you pronounce your first and last name and your pronouns for me?
Yes, Kristen Carbone, she, her.
Awesome. Kristen, I'm excited to have this conversation with you. I have repeatedly snooped your website since Angie introduced us. Tell us a little bit, real quick, who you are, kind of what's going on in your life now, and then we're going to get into it.
Yeah, so thanks so much for having me. I'm Kristen Carbone, the founder of Brilliantly. Brilliantly started in an effort to solve a problem I was having myself. And it led me down the journey of having a business that really is aimed at meeting the long-term quality of life needs of women who've had an experience with breast cancer. I live in Providence, Rhode Island. I'm a mom of two and did a major mid-career pivot into being the founder of in tech. I used to work in the arts. So I'm really excited to kind of dive into the experience of my major shift.
Yeah. And you have built kind of a whole community around Brilliantly. It's not just the product from what I picked up. Tell us a little bit more about Brilliantly for context, and then we'll go to your personal story from there.
Totally. Well, they're definitely interwoven. And I had a preventative mastectomy and reconstruction back in 2013. I unfortunately lost my mom to metastatic breast cancer in her 40s. And when I decided to have that surgery, I wrongfully assumed that I would just go in, have surgery, recover, and never think about it again. And for anyone who has a hereditary risk for an illness or who's experienced an illness, you know that it's sort of top of mind all the time. And one of the things that was sort of strange and unexpected was that I feel cold all the time. And the whole business started because I was trying to make something to make myself feel comfortable in a way that was discreet and safe, because I had been using hot hands and hot water bottles and all kinds of things that were really visible, and also had gotten burned actually from those hot hand things because I used to stuff them in my bra and they get really hot. And when I decided to try to make this and had a friend help me, neither one of us were engineers, and realized really quickly that I had to understand if there were other women who needed it, because making just one thing for me seemed kind of silly. And that's when I learned that the patient experience for women who undergo a mastectomy preventatively, but also women who've had cancer, when you leave the hospital, when you stop going to the doctor all the time, people are like, you did it, go live your life. And you're like, what the heck? I look different. I feel different. No one says, hey, welcome to your new life. And this is what you need to look good and feel good and have conversations with people. And I think in the summer of 2017, I talked to hundreds of women. And I honestly couldn't get over how many people had the experience of people just saying, like, you did it, and thinking that they were done. And that for a lot of people, the healing and the struggle starts after.
Yeah, that's so spot on. My husband is actually a colon cancer survivor, and are very similar. People are like, okay, he's all done. The cancer's gone. And it's like, but there's permanent ramifications. And I feel like I imagine, and correct me if I'm wrong, but especially something like breast cancer or the selective surgery, like for females, our breasts are so tied into our identity, culturally, social, like there's an even bigger implication. My husband can hide the fact he has no colon. Nobody knows, right? You know, unless he's having a bad day. But there's a whole nother level there, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, it was funny because I was never someone who identified my personality and my being by my breasts. I had really small chests to begin with. And so while I understood that, it was funny because in 2013, nobody offered me the option to go flat, which I probably would have almost been more comfortable with because I had a really small chest. And I tried to get really small implants and they just look weird. Like if you can imagine, there's no like soft transition. So I had these like two little weird lumps that like almost floated around. Like they moved under my muscles. And I ended up having much larger breasts than I wanted and I was used to. And my doctor, who was an asshole, by the way, said, well, I gave you great bathing suit tits. And I was like, what? Like, as if I had entered into this for cosmetic reasons. And I think, to your point, the world sees women in a very specific way and desires them to look a specific way. And sometimes it has nothing to do with how we want to look or our choices. And I do think it's definitely a complicating factor. But I think, at least in the last few years, I've seen that there is at least more conversation happening about it. Women are saying, I want to stay flat. I don't want to have implants. I don't want to have more surgery. My breasts don't define me. And sometimes that scene is radical. And every time I see a woman who like made a really empowered, educated choice, I'm like, yeah, good for you, because I just didn't know what I was doing and sort of let my doctor lead me.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. It brings up so many thoughts and questions. So I'm like, okay, where do I start? I guess I'm going to go is kind of back before the surgery then. Kind of a twofold question here. One, like, I know you lost your mom to cancer. Was it a no-brainer for you to make the decision to do the hereditary screening? Like, because that's becoming so easy and so common. My mom did 23andMe and she's like, I don't want to see the genetic results. And I know it's a very controversial thing. So I'm curious your thoughts and decisions even that far back.
It's such a good question. You know, when my mom was sick, the BRCA mutations had been discovered. They were known. And I remember still sitting down with her at our kitchen table at lunch in the early 2000s. And she had a pamphlet from the genetic counselor's office. And she was like, let's read this and decide if we're going to do it. And in the early 2000s, there was no legislation that protected you against insurance discrimination. And so she decided not to have it because she was like, well, what if I have it? And what if you and your brother can't get health insurance? And what if I get denied coverage? Or, you know, so we decided not to do the testing really early on. And then she died in 2005. I had my son in 2008. And it really was in that first year where I reconnected with a professor from college, and she had twin and I think two sisters, and all of them had had breast cancer and she hadn't, and they didn't have the BRCA mutation. And she said, I see a preventative oncologist and I want you to go too, because she knew what had happened to my mom. And I started seeing this woman at NYU who's completely amazing. And I genetic screen in 2008 was $2,000. Like my insurance didn't cover it. And you know, there's lots of predictive models and you go through your whole family health history. My dad is the oldest of 10. So going through the whole family health history was really
expensive. That's a lot.
Yeah, that woman knows like everything about me. And I don't have BRCA, and that was complicated. Like I was really happy to know I didn't have it, but then I didn't. It's like an uninformed negative. That doesn't mean we know if my mom had it or not, or my grandpa, or my maternal great aunt who also had breast cancer. Like it was so much missing information. It didn't mean that I don't have risk. And the physicians that I was seeing had just published a paper that was about early onset breast cancer. So like, when you think about what are the predictors of breast cancer for women who are premenopausal, this study revealed all these things that were seemingly unrelated, but were common traits. So like, just for example, like birth weight over 10 pounds. I was almost 11 pounds. Early first period, I got my period really early. Large head size, which I also have. So there were all of these things that they found as common traits in young women. So when I went to the doctor and said, I don't have BRCA, but my mom died in her 40s. Her aunt died at 50. My, you know, like I said, here's all my stuff. And she said, well, we're going to treat you as if you have BRCA. So I spent years kind of being screened in the same way that other women who had that mutation were getting screened. And it wasn't until during screening, they found a lump and this is like totally medically irrelevant, but it freaked me out. they found a lump in exactly the same spot as my mom's primary cancer. And I was like, I'm done.
Yeah.
So it was not immediate for me. The first time someone told me about preventive mastectomies, I was like, are you fucking crazy? Like, who would do that?
Right.
Yeah, it's me.
Yeah. Well, and that's what's interesting. That's kind of what was going through my brain when you said that you didn't have the BRCA. Like, I was like, oh, then why did you keep going down this path? But like you said, there's family history. There's new research constantly coming out. There's just the reality of having that thing hanging over your shoulder. So when the lump did come up, like, that obviously had to trigger a lot of emotions for you. And it makes sense as you walk through it in the condensed version, how you would come to this decision.
Yeah. And, you know, not for nothing, there's like the emotional component, right? Like, my mom got diagnosed with stage 1A, didn't even have chemo. And when it came back, it was in her brain, her bones, her liver, and her lungs. It was extremely aggressive. They didn't know how to treat it. It was triple negative, which is, there's lots of different kinds of breast cancer. She had a whole tumor board at Johns Hopkins that was trying to figure out how to treat her. Like, it didn't matter that they caught her cancer early. And I felt like, what am I doing? I'm going to wait around and hope that they catch it early and die anyway. Forget it.
Right.
But, you know, there's a whole other side of that decision-making process that's purely practical. I was traveling to New York twice a year. I was getting an MRI, an ultrasound, and a mammogram every year, which some of those things expose you to radiation and other chemicals, which increase your risk over time. And my insurance didn't cover those tests. So when I worked in art museums, which is typically where I was working for most of my career, I was making under $30,000 a year. And I was paying like sometimes upwards of $12,000 a year in diagnostics as a healthy person. And the stress of going for those tests, and they want your BMI to be low. There's all of these other like lifestyle factors that, of course, I haven't abandoned, but they aren't like, you have to do this, you have to do this, you have to do this all the time. And I just thought, I don't want this to be my life where I'm just always waiting for a test or results.
Yeah. So it sounds like the decision, when you hit that tipping point, when you had the lump, the decision to go ahead with the preventative surgery was a relatively easy decision at that point.
Yeah, for me personally, totally. And then to communicate it to people was really complicated. It was Angelina Jolie. I don't know how much you know about the breast cancer space, but Angelina Jolie, like, now pretty famously, wrote a piece about her decision to have, I think, a preventative mastectomy and her ovaries removed. And that was in, I think, late 2013. So it was probably 6 months after I had my surgery. And it helped because it brought it into the popular consciousness. But at the time I was deciding to do it, most people had never heard of it as an option.
Yeah, interesting. Do you find, and maybe this has changed over the last 5 years, are you, quite sure the words I'm looking for, are you accepted in the breast cancer community having done this by choice?
That's such a good and insightful question. And I appreciate you asking it, because I think there are entire online communities that have grown out of the experience of women like me, and we're called pre-vivors. Women who've had cancer, or people who've had cancer, are typically called survivors. And pre-vivors are people who are living with an increased hereditary risk. And some of those people have had surgery and some of them haven't. But these communities have come up online because of how inappropriate it is for us to go and sit in a support group. There are women who are in those, women and men, who are in, you know, an in-person or online support group, who are facing a cancer diagnosis, who are potentially metastatic, and they're like, why are you here? You know? And it's interesting to have seen both sides of that, as someone who is a caregiver for someone dying from cancer, and knowing that she would have wanted any young woman, anyone, any person, to do whatever they could to not be in her shoes, and that she would have full-heartedly supported that decision. But and that a lot of the topics you want to talk about are the same. There's a huge amount of overlap in the human experience. But I do think that there are people who are cancer survivors who are like, why would you do this? But I think that's the exception. And for the most part, I've found that this community is overwhelmingly accepting of each other and always hoping for the best. And of course, there's the, like, a little bit tainted social media version of things, where you only see the good stuff in some people's life and only see the terrible stuff in other people's lives. But I do think I'm at least trying to create a space where everyone is welcome, and that we're trying to address questions that are multifaceted and represent different perspectives in their answers because we're just human, you know? Right. And I might not know exactly what your situation is, but I've been on both sides of it. I think there is not a single person who's a pre-vivor who decided that lightly and who came to it without having a really horrible experience happen to someone who they loved.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think it's great that the community is mostly supportive and that there is that space. That's huge. I think about my husband, I went through infertility. I think about the infertility community and there's kind of this hierarchy of like, what level of treatment did you need? Like, how many times did you have to try before you got a baby? And it was like, really? Like, we're all here struggling with this thing and we can all have empathy regardless of what stage we're at. And like, I could see having space and conversation for kind of the lead up before surgery, because there is like, when my husband was diagnosed with cancer, it was just a rush of booking surgeries. There were not really any choices to make because it was cancer and we had to act quickly, versus like you being able to potentially take a little bit of time. Granted, you obviously don't want to dilly-dally forever, but like to be able to process this a little more. But like once you make those surgical decisions and once you obviously have the surgeries, there's a lot of similarity, I would imagine, in recovery, in decisions to make, like you said, about flap closure or reconstruction or all of those things.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. And it's an interesting thing to think about as someone who is wanting to create content that helps some of those issues, because there's the moment when you're ready to hear it. And for me, that moment for most of us is not when you're trying to decide about surgery. You're just bombarded with choices or no choices and things that you have to do. It's almost survival mode. And then you're in healing mode. And then at the end, you're like, wait, I wish somebody had told me this or that. But like knowing where those touch points are on the patient journey are difficult for sure. And I think that there are universal factors in that, like especially in the physical recovery and in the piece about identity, which you pointed out, like how we think about ourselves, what we feel like in our bodies. And I imagine that for women who are faced with a cancer diagnosis, it's all like a whole other level of complicated. If you need chemo, if you need radiation, if you know what your treatment looks like, those, it's just sort of a different, you know, like you're all headed in the same direction, but the road to get there is a little bit different.
Yeah, definitely. Tell me a little bit about kind of your feelings since then. Did you wake up with some relief? Have you battled regret? Like, what has that journey been?
I've had absolutely zero regret. I literally woke up and was like, thank God. You know, I woke up and there's different ways of doing reconstruction. And I woke up with tissue expanders and was like, almost concave tissue expanders. They create a muscle pocket and they put a thing called an expander and they slowly fill it up with fluid over time to build a space in your chest wall where an implant can sit. A lot of people choose not to do that now. I would never do it again. That was probably the most painful part of the process for me. But when you first wake up with them, you're completely flat and almost concave. And I woke up and looked down and was like, I don't even care. I feel so much better. And I had the thought, like, if this was what I was left with forever, I would be okay. And of course, there's good days and bad days. I kept a blog when I was making the decision to have the mastectomy, because I have a huge family. And as I said, it was kind of hard to tell people and have to, and I know this is true for anyone in any health situation, infertility, IVF, all of it, where you like have to hear everybody's advice and thoughts and feelings on your experience. And you're like, shut up. So like, I'm going to have a blog.
Oh God.
I'm going to email everybody when I publish one. And then I don't have to hear your response. You love me and you care about me and you want to know what I'm doing. So that was how I decided to do it in like 2013. And there's one day where I wrote and was like, I woke up and I didn't know what to wear, where I was like, I feel awful in every single thing I own. And I can't believe this is my body, you know, like, but I would say that is the rare exception. And we all have body image issues. And I sure as shit do too. But they're not typically about regretting that I had the decision. And reconstructive breasts are weird. They move weird. They look weird. You can see dimples and ripples and all kinds of stuff. And there was a point in time where like all I wanted was a turtleneck bathing suit so no one would ever see my chest. But I still felt like I had taken control of my fate in a way that I can always stand behind.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think that I always like to highlight when we have these kind of almost conflicting emotions, because we talk about how you should either be happy or be sad. But like, here you were relieved that you made this decision, that it was done, but also still working through the body image and getting used to this new chest and what it looked like and how it moved. And like, that's okay. Like, I like to highlight that, like, these things happen simultaneously and you can feel both at the same time. You can ricochet from one end to the other.
Yeah, totally. I think that's the whole, I mean, that's everybody's life. And it's that certainly this experience is like, in a nutshell, that, you know, I talk to a lot of people about intimacy and sex. And like, in those conversations with women in 2017, so many people talk to me about their sex life and like never wanting to take their shirt off, never wanting someone to look at them. And it really made me think about how we define beauty and what does that mean, and what, and about gaze and about touch and sensation. And for people who have a lot of pain, and some people have chronic pain, there's a thing called post-mastectomy pain syndrome, where you are actually in chronic pain. And what does it mean when someone touches you? And realizing like how important it is to communicate that to your people, and that we're not taught those skills. And all of us need to do that. It's not just women who've had mastectomies, to be like, this is how I want you to touch me. And when you do this, I feel this. And I need you to X. Or
yes,
I need to keep this on, or I'm going to get like a whole drawer full of like crazy ass lingerie and it's never coming off. Sorry. Like, you have to figure out how to say those things. And it's really hard. And I think it was interesting to talk to people who were in committed, long-term committed relationships and what it meant for the dynamic of their relationship. And then the same thing for people who weren't in one. And they're like, well, I don't know how to talk to them. And I don't have anyone to practice with. And I don't have a trusted partner. And and realizing fundamentally, after all those conversations, that you have to do it yourself. You're the person who always has to do the hard work to feel better. And that's like doing the work and understanding what it feels like. And then saying it, which is so hard. It's so hard to say what you want and need and feel. And we unfortunately live in a culture that never trained us to do that. I kind of think we're in a moment of tide change.
I think you're right. I think the conversations are changing, and God, they cannot change fast enough. Because I see the same in the infertility world. Like, after a lot of IVF, this takes a thing that's supposed to be like fun and romantic and makes it very clinical and very not fun. And like, nobody talks about the impact of a surgery like this on your sex life. Nobody talks about the impact of IVF on your sex life. And then afterwards, then all of a sudden you see these people, then there's this like chunk of the community that like, now afterwards, all of a sudden like, okay, I need to talk about this. And I don't know that I can. And I feel so alone. And I'm ashamed because I'm having these thoughts. Like, we're so focused on the surgical side of it, on the medical side of it. And like, can we add to all of the brochures a section about intimacy? Because like you said, there's so much more that goes into these recoveries than just being physically healed up.
Yeah. And it's so, all of it is so clinical. And there's nothing sexy about clinical feeling things.
No.
And I think there are a lot of physicians who forget that we're people too. And there's so many wonderful, talented doctors who do so much for us in any kind of health situation. And they're also not trained to talk about those things. And they also might feel awkward about talking about sex and intimacy. And, you know, and that might be a gendered thing. That might be an age thing. That might be a religious thing. There's all kinds of reasons people have a hard time caring about that, coupled with how our healthcare system works, and that your doctor's there with you for 15 minutes. And they're not going to ask you about questions that they don't have a good answer for. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I really think that there are a lot of platforms and people who are speaking up about it, like across like the entire lifespan, about these issues that we used to have to just shut up about. And I feel really hopeful about the future and our ability to have those conversations, find people to talk to, because it's so isolating. And I think, you know, we all know we're not really alone, but there's so many moments where you're like, I'm the only person who feels this way.
Yeah, I think the best thing I discovered for my mental health with infertility was the Reddit infertility communities were amazing, and it's anonymous, so you can talk about this really like taboo stuff very honestly. And it's like, once I learned how to talk about there, fortunately I translated that into the real world, and now I'm like, if you're willing to ask the question, I'm willing to answer it, because so many people are dealing with the same things and can't have these conversations or don't know where to start with these conversations, that I think it's amazing to find, you know, other people that are open and willing and able to create these communities and have these conversations.
Yeah, I've heard that about Reddit, and I my funny Reddit story is I joined like a breast cancer thread, and somebody was asking about regrowing their hair after chemo, and I was like, oh, we did a blog post about that, and I put a link to the blog post, and I got banned for life from that. And I was like, wait, why? What did they think I was like? I couldn't figure out what happened. And I was like, I don't understand Reddit. I need to try this again later.
That was aggressive. Oh my gosh. Yeah, I was gonna say Reddit comes with a caveat. Like, I'm in a support group for the surgery that I had recently, this rib cage thing, and most people who have this surgery are teenage boys, and I'm a 37-year-old woman. And so every now and then I'm like, yeah, you guys cannot help me with my questions.
You get it.
This is a good lesson also in, like, I was going to kind of ask also, like, where do people find support groups? Like, how do you vet if a group is the right group for you?
Yeah, that's a really good question too. And I think it's hard. You know, when I first started trying to find women to talk to, I joined Facebook groups, and they're less curated. They often, you have to answer a series of questions to get in if it's about a health issue specifically, so they know there's no one in there trolling. But I think a lot of times misery loves company, you know, like the people who are posting because they're having a bad experience and they want to feel better. And there's not a lot of people going on and being like, hey, I had a great experience. So when you join that, especially if it's in a moment where you're feeling like emotionally uneasy, I can imagine it would be really difficult to see so many people having trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I've found that there are some really great Facebook groups, and that you can use hashtags essentially as a database and search for things you're looking for. But you can always leave a group. Like, I joined probably 15 groups and then was like, oh, that one's not for me. Okay. And not try to not take it personally.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not easy. And people complain about social media all the time, but I do feel like that's how people find their people. Especially, you know, I've met women who are in like rural Arkansas who are the only person in their town who's ever had breast cancer, who had to travel 2 hours for surgery and treatment, and really genuinely were like, I must be the only person under 30 who's ever had this, until they started looking online and were like, oh, wait. And I think it's so absolutely critical that we have those spaces. And, you know, I want to think that hospitals and nurse navigators and some of the people who run in-person support groups can direct people to online things where it's easier to find. Like, if you're like, I'm a 37-year-old woman who lives in Providence, Rhode Island, and wants to find someone else who also, you know, like, you can find that person online. You probably can't find them in your community support group. But yeah, I would encourage join with abandon and also leave when it doesn't feel good.
I love that so much. Yes, leave when it doesn't feel good is such an important part of this. Because like you said, every one of these groups kind of takes on its own identity and its own feel. And if it's not the right group for you, man, like, bounce and find those people. I have 3 girlfriends still to this day. It's been 5 years now that we did infertility treatments together. Started as anonymous friends on Reddit, and we all kind of grew out of Reddit, but decided to kind of keep tabs on each other. And, you know, they will forever understand that part of my life.
Yeah.
And then the rest of it, like, take it and leave it. And when I found myself, I think that, like, yeah, when you find yourself scrolling through the group, getting more and more angry or more and more depressed, that might be the group that you need to go ahead and step out of and find those ones. Yeah, where you're finding information, resources, support, where the support is mutual, those kinds of things.
Yeah, I went to an in-person retreat, and it was like a 4-hour drive from here. And I pulled up to this house and was like, what the hell are you doing? This is insane. You're going to like stay in a house with 30 women you don't know, like, just go home. And I sat in the driveway for probably 10 minutes. And then I walked up to the door, and this woman opened the door, and she was like, oh my God, you're here. And was so friendly. And I met three people there who, there are points where I talk to them every day, you know, because they just, I was like, oh, I'd never met another mom who was in her 30s who decided to have a, you know, like you just find people who have a similar experience and there's an immediate kinship and you, your friendship with them may grow and change and they may only be the people you call when you like need a specific thing related to that part of your life, but it's so important to have them.
Yeah, definitely. What has surprised you about life post-surgery?
So many things. I think the first being that like I still have to think about cancer all the time and still do. Like I have a lump in my armpit now that we still monitor because guess what? Breast tissue goes all the way under your armpits up to your collarbones. It can actually be like all the way down your core. And the standard of care is not just do individual screening to see where all the breast cancer tissue is in a woman's body before giving them a mastectomy, which I think is insane. So I still have breast tissue that needs to get monitored. I think I've never been a joiner. Like I specifically chose my college because there was no football team or Greek life. And the idea that I would build a community is probably insane to like anyone who knew me for the first 30 years of my life. And I think I'm like a community convert. So that's been a really surprising personal thing for me and how amazing it is to be part of that kind of community and really honestly and openly and vulnerably saying, this is how I feel and this is what's happening. And the remarkable response that that gets from people. You know, I saw like some silly meme this morning that was like a candle lighting another candle doesn't do anything negative to the first candle. And it was about like women empowering women. And I was like, yeah, no shit. And I really think that's been my experience has been so overwhelmingly positive, I think. And I just didn't know. I didn't know that was possible. So that's been probably the most surprising thing for me.
I love that. So tell me more than perfect segue. Tell me more about Brilliantly and how that all came about and where it is today.
Yeah, you know, when I had those conversations with women, I was trying to find out, were other people cold? Because I was going to make this like tech device. And I don't even really like technology, but I was like, this is going to be cool. I'm going to learn a new thing. I'm going to make a product. And then in those conversations, I was like, I can't just make a product. I have to help address some of these things that people told me, like, we can't just let this go unanswered. And we started a portrait project, a corrective exercise program. There's a ton of content on the blog that's all really focused around that moment when you become a survivor or a previvor, if you're living long-term with metastatic cancer. And you're when the expectation from everyone is that you're supposed to be a person who functions in the world, that's where I'm trying to meet you and say, hey, there's all of these people here too. And maybe you feel different. Maybe you look different. Maybe your entire life is different, but you're not alone. And I think in the 4 years that I've been doing this, as we've been talking about, there's been a really overwhelming tide change in women's health, I think, from period care through menopause. And I feel really good about being part of that. And there's tons of communities that have come up online around every kind of health experience you can have. And I'm always trying to stay on top of what's out there and how can we be different? And what are other people doing that I can amplify? And what are the ways that I can talk about things that no one's been talking about yet? In addition to like talking to women and creating content and programs, we did eventually launch the Warming product after like a whole lot of hilarious COVID-related problems with supply chain, with fundraising, with like everything. And I know I'm not alone in that either. But we launched with our first version last June, so June of 2021. And we're working on making another run of product to launch for fall of 2022. And it's been totally amazing to have it out there. There's lots of frustrating little things. Is this going to be video or is it just audio? Because I can show you. I have one of the units here. It's called Brilliantly Warm.
Hey, Casey, jumping in here real quick. Since we do these interviews on Zoom, obviously, I can see what's going on. I am going to put this little clip of the video over on Instagram so you can check it out and see for yourself. But for those of you, you know, listening in the audio land, a quick description of Brilliantly Warm. This little contraption is about the size of your whole hand. About half of it is made of a thick neoprene material. I think that's the part that warms up. It looks quite flexible and comfortable. The other half is a very small, thin plastic disc where all of the electronic components are held. Yeah, it's a pretty cool little thing. Pretty comfortable looking. Definitely would be able to fit into the bra in a variety of different ways, as we will discuss.
It fits into any bra, so part of what needed to happen for me was that you we couldn't complicate finding a bra. Finding a bra for anyone is really complicated. And if you've had reconstructive surgery, it's even more complicated. So this, there's a hard plastic part that has the battery, the Bluetooth, the electrical board, and you position that in your bra depending on what shape your bra is, your body is. So some people wear one here and one here. Some people wear them both on the sides with the heater is this thin fabric part. So
okay.
The idea is that you slip Brilliantly Warm into your bra when you're getting dressed, and then it's controlled by an app. So if I'm in the grocery store, I can just do this and turn it on and not have to stick my hand in my shirt to like figure it out. And that works if you're in the boardroom, if you're skiing, if you're wherever you are. And the cool thing that happened once the product launched was that women who have no relationship to breast cancer were buying it too. Like the need for a discreet way to control your personal temperature is pretty universal.
Yeah, it's such a cool device. Yeah, I was thinking about it with my surgery. I was like, I wish I had had that like 4 months ago, just living on a heating pad because my rib cage hurts all the time. I'm like, that's just the perfect little, like you said, and there's different ways to tuck it in, because I kind of looked at it, I was like, oh, I don't know if that would be comfortable because of where my incisions are at, but I didn't even think about the fact I can turn it around and tuck the plastic part wherever feels comfortable. You can wear one or both.
Totally. And I learned that from women using it. They were like, oh, I didn't want to wear it here because I had lymph nodes removed and like this part of my body is really sensitive, or this way it bumped into my incision. You know, like having people actually use it and interact with it, I've learned so much. Like we've done 3 changes to the app since it's been out there because people are like, this notification is super confusing. I'm like, you're totally right. Let's fix that. But overwhelmingly, it's been positive. You know, like women call me crying because it's the first time they feel comfortable again. And I'm like, there's nothing that feels better than knowing that all of that work is actually making someone feel better.
Yeah. And I think this is a lesson of, there's a gal I follow on TikTok, and she's actually an ADHD TikToker, but she talks all the time about you. It's not silly if it works for you. And on one hand, like, let's call it what it is. Boob warmers seem like such a silly thing.
Yeah.
But if that gives you a piece of comfort, a piece of normalcy, if whatever that brings, it's absolutely not silly then if it works.
Oh, totally. It's a really funny thing to talk about for that exact reason. And especially men don't understand it. And it's like, if you have chronic pain, like you're healing. And if you had a way to not be in pain where you could focus, that changes how you feel, and that changes how you talk to your husband, and that changes how you show up at work. And like us being more comfortable makes everything better. And I think women specifically have been suffering silently and stoically for far too long.
Yeah, absolutely. Aside from kind of the obvious of like the business and the product itself, and even the community that was building up before that, what else has Brilliantly brought to your life?
You know, I didn't know when I started this that part of the success of the brand would be that I would have to mine my personal story like to infinity. Because in the beginning, I'm the person I have access to. And it's like, all right, well, what can I write about? Who can I talk to? When I'm interviewing other people, you shared with me about your infertility struggle and about your husband. And I didn't know that in an effort to amplify someone else's message, vision, story, product, service, that I would also have to talk about my own. And so many things have come up for me that I would never have understood about myself if I hadn't started this business. And I think I'm a little bit crazy, and I'm definitely stressed out, and I work a lot, and this has been the hardest thing I've ever done, but I feel like I'm a better person, and it's changed how I parent. It's changed how I think about my friendships and my personal value in the world. Like, it's been such a rewarding experience to do this. I started going gray, I think, because of this too. You know, like there's the good and the bad, as you already talked about. And, you know, specifically, it's been a chapter in me grieving my mom. Yeah. I never would have called myself a caregiver. Like, I just didn't have the language. And I think a lot of our struggles with communication are around language, like not having the words to describe how we're feeling. And we did an event during COVID where 4 different caregivers shared their story. And I asked my dad to go to it too, because he's sort of like present, but not like overly in my business. And I said, I think you should come to this. There's a man who's been caring for his wife for years. There's a man who lost his wife. Like, there's interesting people telling their stories, and I think you might get something out of it. And he called me after crying. He was like, I didn't know how much good work you were doing. And I was like, I don't know what you thought I was doing. But also, I, in that moment too, was like, oh shit, we trauma bonded during this time together. Like, this was my formative growing up years, was as a caregiver. And then I took care of my elderly grandmother, and then I had children. And then I was like, oh, right. I became this person because of this experience of my mother. And I don't know that I knew that. And it's such a silly thing to say, because I knew it was a big, important thing that happened to me, but I didn't know that it completely formed me in a way that I maybe have a choice over.
Yeah. I think that's such a beautiful and important point. So often when I talk to people who are coming out of traumatic things, they're trying to find a purpose for it. They're trying to like make something out of it, make it worthwhile, whatever the words you are that you want to use. And they look at people who are running a business who's essentially built on this thing. And I think we forget that part of the conversation of having to constantly look at your own story and listen to your own story again. And I think that's what makes a company like yours so beautiful and powerful. But also, I like to remind people that you're not obligated to take these paths. And if you start down this path and it's not working for you, I have a friend whose daughter passed away of muscle cancer, started a nonprofit in her memory. It was beautiful for like 5 years, but took so much from her in a way she couldn't kind of recruit from. It's like, it's okay to shut the doors on that. Like,
yeah,
you know, and see where else this change plays in your life and how else you can give back. And I have some friends from the infertility world who that part of their life is a thing for them and their therapist. And that's 100% a valid choice. And there's, you know, people like you and I who put it out for the world to see, and that's a valid choice. And there's an in-between where I'm sure you do a lot of the same too, where I spend a lot of time talking in bathrooms with girlfriends at the gym who confess that they just had a miscarriage or whatever. And it's like, this is the thing. We can just do this intimate one-on-one conversation. And I'm so glad when I have those moments where I know another woman feels seen for a minute, even if I never see her again.
Totally. I think that's such an important point, and I'm glad you said it, because it's a choice. You know, like, you and I are making a choice. And within that choice, there's still a very specific criteria of what I do talk about publicly. But in a bathroom, across from the table with someone, there are no questions someone can't ask me. Like, I want to be seen as someone who you can show up as just you, and you can ask me any question, and we can have a conversation without judgment that's really honest. And that doesn't mean that I'm going to share every single part of my life on the internet or on podcasts, but it does mean that I want to be a resource, and not everybody needs to make that choice. Yeah. There's so many people. This is like the silliest thing. Right before COVID, I was in the mall in Providence with my kids, like getting them sneakers or whatever. And this woman came up to me and she said, are you Kristen from Brilliantly? And I was like, what? And I said, yeah, I am. And she said, I've been following you. And I said, oh, what's your handle? Like, have we talked, you know, like, have you commented? Like, do I know you? And she was like, no, my account's totally private. I just follow. No one even knows that I had a mastectomy. But I found you and I follow you, and I never like anything because I don't want anybody, you know, like, there are a ton of people who need to hear these stories who are never going to come out on the internet or on a podcast or in a book or on a blog and share their intimate experience. And that doesn't mean that they don't need to hear someone else's.
And it doesn't mean just because you're not getting a lot of likes or views. This is me reminding myself when I'm looking at my own analytics, just because it's not getting a response doesn't mean that somebody's not watching it that really, really needs that message too.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Cool. Is there any last thoughts or kind of words of warmth that you have for my audience?
Yeah, I love words of warmth since we're in warming. No, just that, you know, if your listeners ever want to chat, if they are people in the breast cancer community, if they're caregivers, if they have questions, if they're interested in starting a business, they're into wearable tech, like, I'm open to hearing from everybody. I love meeting new people. You can reach out to me directly at kristen@brilliantly.co. And thank you so much for having me and for sharing your story too. It was such an wonderful conversation.
Perfect. And thank you so much for your honesty. This was wonderful. Your information will be in the show notes and on my website so that you're easy to find.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much. Have a great day, Casey. Yeah,
thanks.